This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today, we're getting an in-depth update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. We'll talk about why we're seeing a second wave here in the state and what you can do to stay safe. And we'll find out what health experts are concerned about for the weeks and months ahead. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. We just need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by two guests. Shandy Dearth is a lecturer and director of undergraduate epidemiology education at Indiana University's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Shandy, it's great to have you back.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
And Brian Dixon is Director of Public Health Informatics and an Associate Professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Brian, great to have you back as well.
Great to be back with you, Matt.
All right. So, Brian, let's get an update. Can you explain what the situation is like in Indiana right now? What does it mean that we're in a second wave?
Yeah, so the second wave means that we are once again on the upclimb or incline of cases. We see growing numbers of cases from day to day and week to week. So the first wave really hit us initially back in March after we found the first case of coronavirus and began doing testing throughout the state. We began to monitor this epidemic in the state, and we saw numbers and hospitalizations climb throughout March and into the middle of April. And then we saw cases decline over the summer and kind of flatten out for a while. And this second wave that we're in now is happening across the state, where we see numbers in all regions of the state really climbing for the last several weeks.
How does Indiana compare to other states right now?
Yeah, so we are in the middle of the kind of Midwest spike. So if you look nationally at what's happening, our neighbors are climbing in a very similar pattern as Indiana. So Illinois, Michigan, Kentucky, for example, Wisconsin probably gets a lot of the national attention because the rates there are probably the highest in the country. Per capita, I think the North and South Dakota are seeing incredibly huge spikes in cases as well. But Indiana is climbing at about the same rate as our neighboring states and on par with the rest of the Midwest, which is not a good thing.
Is there any exception to that, I guess, within the Midwest? And we can look nationally as well. Are there any Midwestern states that seem to be handling it better or have lower numbers for one reason or another?
Yeah, so rates in Ohio have started to plateau. So I think if you look at some of the counties that are on the western edge of Ohio, the ones that are right on the Indiana border, those are still increasing. But the further east you head, things start to sort of calm down a little bit in terms of coronavirus cases. So that means Ohio as a whole is beginning to flatten out. But I think the rest of the Midwest is right in there with us.
Shandy Dearth, how worried do you think people in Indiana should be, I guess, when you see these numbers? Do attitudes, maybe the level of seriousness taken, does that need to change?
I think so. I think we've all heard that phrase, COVID fatigue, pandemic fatigue, and I understand we're all getting there. But the problem is we're going to see ourselves in that same position we were in the spring, where we need to flatten the curve. So even though we've learned a lot about coronavirus over the last few months, and we've learned a little bit more about how to treat it, unfortunately, we don't have unlimited bed space. We don't have unlimited numbers of doctors and nurses to treat patients. And so we really need to pay attention and be on alert still. Even though we've been on alert for most of this year, it needs to continue through the winter.
So needing to flatten the curve, I mean, what could that look like? People don't want to hear that we might go into lockdown again, but it seems like that's a possibility and there are a number of forces affecting that, I guess. What does that mean?
So I think we really need to limit the number of people we're around outside of our household. Just because something is open and just because we can do something doesn't mean we should be doing something. And so even though most of the state is at stage five and things are open, what we're seeing is a lot of transmission among larger family gatherings. A lot of these people report going out to restaurants and bars. Again, you've got to make sure you're being very careful. You're staying 6 feet away. You're not in enclosed areas when you don't need to be. If there are outdoor dining options still, outdoor options to meet up with your family, that's definitely preferred. Ventilation can be key in this. Mask wearing has shown time and time again to help decrease transmission. And again, 6 feet away whenever possible.
Brian, I want to come back to you on what might be causing this second wave. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, there's a number of likely factors that played a role in the start of the second wave. So the second wave really began in the middle of September. We've been tracking increasing rates since then. Initially, the numbers were going up slightly each week, and now they're going up more rapidly. But it really started a couple weeks after Labor Day. So could be that people, started to increase these social gatherings around Labor Day and after Labor Day. The other thing that I think has contributed a lot to it is the cooling down of the Midwest that we saw in September. So if you remember, we had a really nice sort of into August and a great Labor Day weekend, and then weather moved in from the north, from Canada, and really affected the entire Midwest, and that moved people indoors. And as Shandy mentioned, whenever you're indoors with poor ventilation with a group of people for a long period of time, that's really where we see transmission occur. So I think that has helped drive cases up. So we've got some great weather this week, which means it may be a good time to get back outdoors, but I think that the cold weather we've had even over this weekend is helping to drive people indoors, and that's where the transmission is largely occurring.
And Shandy, I mean, I'd like to get into talking about the confluence of COVID and flu season later in the show, but because Brian just mentioned being inside, isn't that part of why this time of the year is always the ramp up of flu season, the fact that more people are in close quarters and are more susceptible, or is there more to it?
That's actually a huge piece of it. You're indoors, poor ventilation just because you're breathing the same air over and over again. And so it just spreads that much easier.
Brian, have the demographics of who's getting the virus, the coronavirus, changed at all?
It has. We saw this summer most of the new cases were driven by younger people, particularly individuals who were under 40 years of age. A lot of people, especially in their early 20s, they were out and socializing, and we saw rates go up in that population. And since middle of September, when the second wave began, the demographics of the individuals now getting coronavirus has kind of aged a little bit. So now we see, frankly, rates of new cases among 50 and 60 and 70 year olds and above at similar rates to 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, and 40-year-olds now. So whereas more than half of the cases this summer were younger adults, now there's kind of an equalization of new cases across the ages. And that gives us a lot of concern because we know that the older populations are more susceptible to hospitalization.
Brian, can we also contrast this second wave with the first wave based on how the virus is traveling? It's my understanding that in the first wave, the virus went from densely populated areas into more sparsely populated areas. Is the same happening this time, or is something different happening?
something different. We actually see the reverse happening in this second wave. So the second wave was really triggered in the more rural counties of the state. So areas around, for example, Terre Haute down to Evansville, as well as some of the rural counties up and around Allen County, Fort Wayne area, we saw, and even out near Muncie in some of the counties south of Muncie towards the Louisville-Cincinnati region, we saw this kind of second wave begin there and then has moved back into the more urban populated areas. And we're continuing to see the, some of those more rural counties be more strongly affected during this second wave, which is not what we saw before. As you alluded, we saw it start in the urban areas. And then, I mean, for several weeks, if not a couple months, there were almost no cases kind of down around Evansville. And then we saw them, you know, some cases happened this summer, but that area in particular was part of the leading edge of this second wave.
Shandy, can we point to any possible reason for that, the fact that this wave seems to be building in rural areas?
I think there were a number of factors involved. One is that we saw, you know, as the colleges opened, some of the numbers increased. So areas away from Marion County started seeing some increases. But also the statewide mask mandate, you know, came after some of the larger counties that already implemented mask mandates. So I think it was kind of slower just to slow that first wave anyway in some of the rural areas. But then again, just how we see people approaching COVID has been different sometimes in some of the rural areas versus the urban areas. Some of the rural areas have been a little slower to take up the mask use, that sort of thing. And then also you've got to remember some of the urban areas have not yet gone to stage five. And so they still have reduced capacity at restaurants and bars, reduced capacity in some of the schools even. So perhaps they're doing more of the hybrid schedules, that sort of thing, depending on what county they're in. So I think making the effort to keep the large crowds separated has helped keep the transmission slower in some of these urban areas versus the rural areas, which are mostly on stage five at this point.
We're getting an update today on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana the day before Election Day, and we will get back with our guests after a quick break. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We have a great panel, a live panel this hour, so get your questions into 866-476-3881 or with our All in Vox Pop app. It's free. Wherever you get apps for your phone, just search All in Vox Pop, and you can send us a high-quality audio message that way. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. The number of new cases is rising, a trend recognized as the second wave for Indiana since the pandemic began. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. And we will get your message in front of our great panel today, which includes Shandy Dearth, a lecturer and director of undergraduate epidemiology education at Indiana University's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We've had Shandy on before, as have we Brian Dixon, director of public health informatics and an associate professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. And again, to get your message in front of our panel today, 866-476-3881 or use the All In Vox Pop app for your phone, and you can get it wherever you get apps for your phone. Just search All In Vox Pop, and you can send us a high-quality voice message that way. So let's continue now. Shandy, you do a lot of work on contact tracing. Has the contact tracing process changed in any significant way? Is it getting better or worse for any reason?
Definitely adding volume. I believe the State Department of Health is adding to their team. We've been adding to our team in Marion County. The process has pretty much stayed the same. I think we're continuously working on the script, on the data aspect, but overall it hasn't really changed. The main goal is really to reach out to those people who have been in contact with a case, notify them they've been in contact, and to encourage them to get testing. And I would say that's one thing that we can do more of now, is that there's so much testing available. There's no reason not to get tested. There's lots of free available testing throughout the state of Indiana. So that's one message we're trying to push even more now than we were back in the spring.
Are there tests that are more or less reliable than the others? I keep hearing about, you know, the 48-hour test, and I also hear about the rapid tests. Should we be trusting the results that we get back more or less on any of these?
In general, most physicians will ask that the patient get tested again if they have a positive rapid test. The tests have improved over time, and all of the state sites right now are using the nasal swabs, which have a pretty good rate. I trust those tests, and so I would encourage people not to hesitate to look if you need to get tested, if you've been around someone, to check out one of those state sites. You can Google them. You can find them on the State Department of Health website. They're available throughout the state, and so I think they're pretty reliable at this point.
Back to contact tracing. What's the biggest challenge behind contact tracing right now in your experience?
So just getting people to answer the call, answer the door. As we're calling someone, what we've encountered is a lot of times these telecom providers might not use or show the caller ID that the State Department of Health is using or that we're using. And so there are just some technical issues that we just cannot get around no matter what kind of service we purchase. And so we're trying to do more messaging out there to say, please answer the call. We realize it goes against our instinct to not answer a phone call from a number that you don't recognize, but it might be a contact tracer somewhere in the state warning you that you've been in contact with someone with COVID and that you should be tested. So go ahead and take that leap of faith over the next few months. It might be a stranger calling about something else, but there's also a chance it could be one of the contact tracers that's really trying to reach out and help you.
What's the protocol you work with? I mean, if they don't answer, do you call back? Do you leave a message? What do you have to do?
So at the state level, what they do is they make multiple calls over so many hours. Once that case is deemed as lost to follow-up, meaning that case has not responded to a phone call, a text message, that sort of thing from the Indiana State Department of Health, at that point, that case is sent to the local health department. So that's where we come in at the Marion County level. We're assisting the Marion County Public Health Department. We will then take that case over. We, again, will try and do a phone call. We've got access to some other patient management databases where we could look up some alternative phone numbers, home addresses, that sort of thing. We're still not able to connect with that person over the phone, we actually go to the person's house. So we do a home visit to really stress the fact that we need to talk with that person and to let them know again that they should be tested. And sometimes what we find is people are willing to stay home during the 14 days of quarantine when they've been a contact of a case, but they might need assistance doing so. They might need access to a food bank or some other type of social assistance. And we're happy to help connect them with that, so we can enable them to stay home, help them keep the community safer.
I want to get Brian Dixon's thoughts on this, but Shandy, one more question before I turn to him. And Brian, be thinking about how you might answer this as well. Is there anything that could make contact tracing more effective, some policy or maybe a change in methodology?
That is a great question. I guess just if we could get the telecom providers to always show that caller ID, I think that would probably take some sort of federal rule change on that. But I think that's been a big issue that we've seen. Once we can get someone on the phone, for the most part, most people talk with us. It's just getting them to pick up the phone is the biggest issue. And just getting information out there to the public to let them know why we're allowed to have this medical information and that we do keep it confidential and what the whole purpose is. And again, just the fact that people should get tested. I don't know if that message was clear out there in the beginning, that we encourage people to get tested. You don't have to be symptomatic in order to be tested.
Brian, from what you've seen, are there ways contact tracing needs to improve?
Yeah, there's a number of ways that it could possibly improve. it's hard to do that during a pandemic, but some things that I was, you know, that I think probably we should think about from a policy level. One is, you know, if everyone, if there was sort of an app for contact tracing, like one app that sort of everyone in the state used or everyone in the nation used for things like, you know, renewing your driver's license or something like that, we could probably reach out to people easier. You know, the country of Denmark has kind of integrated a lot of its civil services like BMV registration and healthcare identifiers to kind of connect people's records and get a hold of them quicker. And they're about the same as a country, they're about the same size as the state of Indiana. So that would be one thing from a technology piece that would help get around some of the challenges that Shandy talked about. From a policy perspective as well, there are several things I think we could think about as a state. So one of the biggest challenges, as Shandy alluded to, for people who are close contact and need to quarantine at home, it's just really hard for some people to do that. Maybe they live, you know, they have a large family and it's hard for them to physically separate themselves from the rest of the members of the family that they live with, or they're the only sort of breadwinner in the family and they really kind of need to go to their job in order to earn income. So they may be hesitant to stay home because they face some of these challenges. Could be a childcare issue. It could be, the fear of not having that job when they go back. We've heard stories about people who've essentially been fired because they just chose to quarantine themselves at home and not go back to their job. And so we could think about policies that would make it illegal for businesses to fire people because they were making the right choice for the community in terms of population health. We could also think about policies that would or services that would really strengthen people's ability to quarantine. So offering them assistance in the form of, you know, being able to go to a community shelter or a hotel or something to get away from the rest of their family so they don't spread it to them. Those would be policies and programs that we could think about to really strengthen our ability to help people out. And there are some of those services out there, but they're being offered by community-based organizations, which is wonderful, but not necessarily supported in a holistic way by state policy.
We are talking to Brian Dixon, Director of Public Health Informatics and Associate Professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We also have Shandy Durth, a lecturer and Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at Indiana University's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health as well with us. And we're just getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, where Indiana is on this, the Monday before Election Day. And we would love your input, 866-476-3881, to leave us a message to put in front of our panel. Or you can get with us on Facebook or Twitter. We're at All In Indiana. Leave a comment or question there and we'll get it in front of our panel. Or All In Vox Pop, our app, which is free to send us a high quality voice message. All In Vox Pop. Get it wherever you get apps. So, Brian, I'm curious what you think Indiana should do right now. Obviously, there's tremendous political pressure on the governor not closing the state down or clawing back to a phase 4.5 or a 4, maybe even a 3. I've heard tossed around as being a possibility. What do you, someone with knowledge of epidemiology, what do you think we should be doing right now?
Yeah, I do think that we need to think, trigger some of those rollbacks, I think, to some of those previous stages that we were in. Governor laid out a nice plan and said it would be data driven, and the data would certainly tell us that the indicators are moving in the wrong direction and we need to probably roll things back. I think the biggest source of concern are group gatherings. So whether those are large family gatherings or weddings or funerals or other activities where we would, gather together and embrace others and be in close contact with them, we need to start thinking about how to make those much smaller. So putting restrictions in place around how many people can attend an event. With being in stage 5 like we are, I think the limit is around 250 people, right? Without needing sort of special permission from the county health department to have that gathering. Really, we should be looking at much smaller gatherings, and maybe putting, you know, if we roll back to some of those earlier stages, we can kind of have some effect on that. The same thing with, say, bars and nightclubs. Not that we want to go back to where we're shutting everything down, but putting limits on how many people can, you know, be in that establishment. Because when you're in an environment where there's, you know, loud music or a lot of people, and you have to talk loudly to your friends or people that you're sitting next to, then that's where we see this sort of airborne virus go right across the table to those people. And when you're out eating and drinking, it's hard to keep a mask on the whole time that you're sitting at the bar or that you're sitting at that table. And so we may need to think of, we should think about policies that would take us maybe a half step back or a full step backwards in order to get this virus under control.
Shandy Dirth, one of Governor Holcomb's challengers, the Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater, has been campaigning on, been campaigning against the mask mandate. And of course, that is appealing to the conservative wing of well, I guess the populace who might otherwise vote Republican and might otherwise vote for Governor Holcomb, who has handled this pandemic by a lot of opinions pretty well. Do you think that we might end up going back to some form of not lockdown, but some other phase of being more cautious after Election Day? Do you think this Election Day threshold has anything to do with it?
I can definitely see, as our numbers increase, the need to roll back, as Brian said, take a step back, perhaps. And I think if it doesn't happen at the state level, we will probably get to the point where we see more of the local health officials starting to pull back some at the local level, at least. I think it warrants it at this point. Our numbers are going up too quickly.
You, Shandy, and other health experts have for months stressed the importance of getting the regular flu vaccine this season. Why is that so crucial this year?
So for a number of reasons. One is we never want people to get the flu if it can be prevented. Two, we're already going to have a lot of people in the hospital with COVID, and so capacity is already going to be reduced. So you don't want to risk getting the flu and not having your spot in the hospital if needed. But also something that I keep stressing with everyone I know is that if you get any symptom from the flu this year, everyone's going to assume it's COVID, and they are going to exclude you from school and work and every other place. Because right now we pretty much have to assume it's COVID. That's what all of the policies are. And so I encourage everyone to save yourself the headache and about a flu and go ahead and get your flu vaccine. That way, if you get symptoms, you can at least tell your healthcare provider, I was vaccinated. You're a lot less likely to get poor effects of the flu if you've been vaccinated, a lot less likely to be hospitalized. So not only will you not be a flu case, but you also won't be excluded for possibly being a COVID case in the future. So it just, you know, it takes that out of the equation.
Save yourself the headache in more ways than one, I suppose. Do we know what it might be like if someone were to get both COVID and the flu at the same time? Are there enough cases we can point to as to what that would do to a person?
I don't believe we've had enough cases yet. We have had some cases already documented here in the U.S. of co-infection. And in general, usually don't want to try and mix a brand new virus that you've just learned about this year with flu. You know, flu can be deadly on its own. Mm. I definitely would not want any loved one to have both flu and COVID at the same time. The respiratory effects could be pretty profound for some people.
Brian Dixon, how are you seeing different areas of the state impacted lately? I mean, how different is the experience for people right now, depending on where they live? We've kind of touched on this so far, but if there's another way we could look at it.
Yeah. So, I mean, one way to look at it is there are right now some hospitals in this state that are out of ICU beds, like they're completely full, and they're having to transfer patients to other facilities. Fortunately, that's not facilities here in Indianapolis. And so I think that if you live in and around the state capitol, this may not be very visible to you because the health systems here, as I mentioned, it started in the rural areas and it's kind of moving now into the urban areas. So the spread of infection is higher kind of the further you get away from downtown Indianapolis, at least for the moment. And so there are places in the state where first of all, if you live in an area that's serviced by a critical access hospital, that hospital really doesn't have ICU beds to take care of people who get really sick from COVID-19. And so those facilities are going to end up transferring a lot of the patients that they receive to regional facilities. And some of those regional facilities are now full in their ICU. And so they are going to need to transfer those patients even further away from the person's home. And also is going to probably disrupt, especially in those communities, the ability for people to go in for other types of surgeries and healthcare procedures. So once the hospital, you know, is full of COVID patients, then they can't take people for other conditions. So that means that if you have another condition where you would need to be hospitalized, you need immediate surgery for, you know, your appendix bursts, or you need to have an urgent surgery for cancer, for example, then you're going to have to go further away from your home for that procedure. And that may not necessarily, you know, cause you to die, but it could be more expensive. It could be more of a headache. Your family, you could feel isolated because you're much further away. So there are communities right now in our state that are experiencing some of this and beginning to sort of feel the real impacts of COVID-19 more so than, say, in some of our urban areas, where at least for the moment, there seem to be plenty of spaces for COVID patients.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with health experts about the latest news around the COVID-19 pandemic. And when we come back, we will look at the upcoming holiday season and what we need to be thinking about when it comes to gatherings. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. As always, we would love your questions and comments. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. And we have one of those to share with you just momentarily. But first, let me reintroduce our guest. Shandy Durth is a lecturer and director of undergraduate epidemiology education at Indiana University's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Brian Dixon is also with us. He's Director of Public Health Informatics and an Associate Professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We do have a listener voicemail to share. This is from Dona with a question about the holiday season. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Dona from Indianapolis. I actually had a comment or a question about the COVID response and the protocols that are in place. I'm wondering about family get-togethers, especially with the holidays coming up. I've been trying to encourage my family members to keep gatherings small or avoid them altogether, and I'm having trouble getting that message through, and I'm feeling kind of bad about not attending some of those gatherings. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions of what we should, what types of protocols we should be following there. Thank you.
Brian Dixon, my family just decided to not have the big Thanksgiving this year and instead maybe keep things a little bit smaller, a little more close-knit, maybe get some testing done before we meet up, take those proper precautions. How much of an impact could this holiday season have on what we're seeing right now?
Yeah, so the holiday season is potentially going to further explode the number of cases we see. We've seen essentially, you know, the number of new daily cases kind of double over the last month. And the holiday season is likely to exacerbate that, you know, maybe leading to tripling or quadrupling if people get together without taking any precautions.
And so, Shandy, what would you tell Dona about her situation? What advice would you give her, if any?
Well, first I would say as a public health person, I feel her pain because I'm usually that person in my family having those conversations. Mm. And I would say it is best for people to keep these family gatherings this holiday season with people who already live in the same household so that you're not extending the number of potential cases in your family. If you absolutely have to see other family members for the holiday season, I would really recommend trying to basically quarantine yourself for 14 days before you head out to see those other family members. That would be one of the best things you could do. Make sure that people are using masks if you are together indoors. Really encourage people to try and meet outdoors if possible. So say you've got that family member who never offers to do the Thanksgiving meal, but they live south, someplace warmer than it might be here in central Indiana come the end of November. Maybe you can encourage that person to host instead. Another idea that we floated around the School of Public Health is encourage people to go in staggered times at a family get together. So perhaps you have grandma and grandpa go first. You know, the older people who might be immunocompromised or at greater risk of death for COVID, they go first without the big crowd around. They visit, they get their meal, they leave, and then other people come into the house. Again, these family gatherings need to be kept small. We don't see as many cases or as many severe cases with children, but that's, you know, not impossible. And so we really encourage people to be willing to give up some of these family get-togethers this year so that you can have many more celebrations with them in the future. Once we have a vaccine, people are vaccinated and COVID is not such a threat.
Well, let's talk about vaccines. We've heard a lot more about vaccine trials lately. Where are we in that process, Shandy?
So if anyone really wants to dig into details on this, the New York Times actually has a great vaccine tracker. I've been looking at it myself off and on just to stay updated. Right now, here in the U.S., the two vaccines we're looking at that will probably be done earliest, if they work, are from Moderna and Pfizer. And they're both using a new gene-based technology, which requires the vaccine to be stored at ultra-cold temperatures. So that's creating a whole logistics issue that we'll have to encounter, but hopefully by the end of this year, we will hear if at least one of those vaccines is actually effective and if it will go into mass production. And hopefully in the spring, we will have some vaccine available for distribution.
Would you say that springtime is when we can anticipate we could have a vaccine be widely available, or will we be in short supply even then?
You know, it's going to take a few months to make that much vaccine and to get it out there into the community. So I'm hopeful that we will have some in the spring available, at least to first responders, healthcare workers. And then as more supply becomes available, that's when it will go out to the rest of the population. So I think we'll be, you know, working on vaccination into next summer.
I mean, we've talked to some people on the show about those logistical concerns about distributing the vaccine. What are some of the problems you see coming to Indiana, I guess, specifically as we work to get vaccines out to everyone?
So in general, hospitals, health departments, they don't have the capacity for cold storage at such a cold temperature. So a lot of the vaccines that we use right now in the U.S. require refrigeration, but not freezer capacity. And so just getting your hands on enough freezer space is an issue, and you've got to keep it frozen throughout the entire chain of command, basically. So as it's being transported on the planes out to, you know, the big semis moving it around the country, out to the health departments and the hospitals, it's got to maintain that temperature or the vaccine just won't work. And so that's a new thing that everyone's scrambling to understand right now. The process itself of distributing vaccine is something that health departments and hospitals and other health agencies have worked on for years. And so even before the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, the U.S. federal government required agencies to have all these plans in place for mass distribution of flu vaccine, because we kind of figured a big flu was coming at some point. It'd been a number of years since we'd had a big flu. So a lot of those plans are in place. But this whole issue of the freezer, that kind of throws a wrench into the plan. And so you've got to add on the extra layer of planning and logistical work for it.
Brian, I want to talk about pandemic fatigue. Is there any way that you have thought of or discussed as a way to combat it? How do you help maintain the level of concern you think people need to have, especially when this is so unprecedented and so many people are increasingly eager to just get back to normal?
Yeah, it's really a hard kind of problem to solve. I think many of the solutions that we have for it or ideas that have been put forth for dealing with pandemic fatigue are kind of similar to those that we often sort of prescribe for seasonal affective disorder, right? Which is also a problem as we head into winter. You know, the sun kind of disappeared for most of last week, and so a lot of people were kind of yearning to see the sun again and get outside. So, you know, taking a walk outside and kind of, you know, taking a break from kind of the Zoom and online meeting fatigue that many of us are experiencing to connect with loved ones or for working from home, I think is really important. But it's really hard to kind of get over that. Many people in our community, they like to go for, you know, they like to go visit family. They like to go on family vacations. They like to, just get out and be social with friends. And I think part of the challenge as, you know, we see signals like we're entering, you know, stage five and messages that, you know, we've really, you know, we've got this thing tackled, don't help. They kind of signal to us that it may be okay to go out. And so it really takes, you know, more effort on the part of, I think, public health to get the message out that it's not quite safe enough to resume normal operations, right? Or normal gatherings. So I think, you know, we need to come up with some creative ways, I think, to connect with people and make new traditions, so to speak, for this holiday season in particular, that we, you know, can maybe keep in the future in addition to our normal gatherings. But we need to sort of kind of fight this pandemic fatigue with, you know, messages of sort of love, like I'm not going to get together with you because I care about you. And I want to make sure that we can do lots of activities when it's once again safe to get together.
Brian, I asked Shandy in the last segment about her opinion on how Indiana is handling things right now, or a little bit around that. And I'd kind of like to get your perspective. What about you? I mean, how is Indiana government handling things right now?
Well, I think, from an objective perspective, you know, the state kind of was really on top of this early on. They gathered a lot of data. They came up with, I think, you know, a solid plan for what they would do based on the indicators. But as we headed kind of into the fall, you know, our numbers began to go up. And I think there's a lot of reticence to put more restrictions back in place, because I think anybody in public health has received numerous phone calls and emails from business owners and from individuals. There's a lot of people who feel like these restrictions, infringe on their Bill of Rights, freedoms, and that hurt a lot of businesses. And we know that this pandemic has had a lot of hardship on people, including economic hardship. And we're not ignoring that fact. But when you're trying to sort of weigh sort of the health of the entire state, the health of all these populations, particularly vulnerable populations, against, you know, the short-term kind of impact economically, it makes sense that we would have to put restrictions in place when our numbers got to a certain level. And so I think that in general, the state's been handling it fairly well. However, you know, more recently, as we've seen data go, the data tell us that trends are going up, there's just been sort of this political reluctance to do things because people are kind of over it. There's a very loud minority of people sort of saying, you know, don't infringe on our rights. And so there's some hesitation to kind of put some of those restrictions we saw earlier in the year back into place, even if they might be necessary.
Shandy, I want to get a follow-up from you. I mean, there are other efforts to fight the pandemic that are happening at different levels, all the way from really localized neighborhood projects to the, you know, the entire state administration. Are there any points, I guess, on that spectrum or along that spectrum that, that need more attention, more focus than maybe they're getting right now?
I would say there's no one key to stopping the pandemic, and so we need all of these pieces in play. So we need strong contact tracing. We need large groups not to get together. You know, the mask mandate, all of those are required. It takes a lot of steps to pull all of this together. We're dealing with a very contagious infectious disease. So I think we need to be willing to take those extra steps that Brian talked about and seriously look at pulling back some of the opportunities to gather in large crowds that we've been seeing. That's driving a lot of the transmission.
Well, it could be. Could it also be something like you would see in an interpersonal dynamic where you might listen to where one friend says a lot and another friend says a little. And so when that other friend that says a little says something, you listen to them more. Right now, we're hearing a lot from the state. Would it be better if some of that messaging might be coming from elsewhere along that spectrum? What are some other ways we could all be kind of helping out and getting the message that people need to hear?
I think this definitely needs to come from friends and neighbors. It's not, the message isn't going to hit everyone if it's just coming from government, because we all know everyone has different views on their own government, how much you should listen to your government, that sort of thing. I think putting that personal story in the public health message is important. So it's not just the number of people who died, but it's, you know, this person who lost their mother, this person who lost their sister. Those are the stories that we need to get out there, because I think the numbers have gotten so large, people can't wrap their brains around it. And we need to remind everyone that these are Hoosiers that we're losing every day, and that there's not a need to keep losing more. There's something we can do. It's not out of our control.
Brian, there's been a lot of talk leading up to the election tomorrow about the pandemic. Different candidates have laid out their plans with varying degrees of specificity for how to move forward. What have you heard as you've listened to some of those big conversations that sounds good? You don't need to endorse a candidate or anything like that, because I know you're not going to. But what's the right approach to take right now?
Yeah, so I think the right approach would be to take a look at our, you know, based on the data, to have us put some restrictions in place on the ability for people to gather in, you know, in confined spaces, you know, that probably have bad ventilation, right? So putting some restrictions in place that will help us get better control of this virus, which means probably moving backwards in our stage plan. You know, whatever that candidate is going to call it, that's essentially what we need to probably put in place. Secondly, we need to really, I think, ramp up our ability to test. So the state has been doing a fairly good job of putting infrastructure in place to allow for testing. But what we've seen over time is people desire less the ability to go out and get tested unless they have symptoms of the disease or they become a close contact and they are, you know, they pick up that phone and talk to a contact tracer and have some motivation to go out and get testing. We really probably need to be more aggressive in our testing so we can identify people who don't have any symptoms of the disease so we can get them isolated and get this under control so they don't accidentally spread it to other people. So I think what I think the strategies that would be best for us would be the kind of, you know, aggressive, more aggressive on the testing, even stronger emphasis on expanding our capacity for contact tracing and providing support for individuals who need to quarantine. So I think if we can do those three things, we can really drive down our positivity numbers, our numbers of new cases, and the hospitalizations and everything. Everything will come down if we can kind of wrap our arms around the disease and kind of keep it at a minimal level.
Well, I want to thank both of our guests for taking the time today. Brian Dixon is Director of Public Health Informatics and an Associate Professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Brian, thanks.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
And Shandy Dearth, the lecturer and director of undergraduate epidemiology education at Indiana's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Always great to have the both of you. Shandy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. And a big thanks to Chris Flood, who has been filling that role for the last week. If you would like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow is we'll have a conversation on poll workers and other election personnel and ongoing concerns about the process. And tomorrow night, you can join us again for an all-in election night special. We're doing a live show from 7 to 8 Eastern with political analysts and reporters from around the state to get results from local races and talk about whatever we can. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.